Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, and welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. I'm Joe Holland. As part of our series focusing on representation in the Labour Party, Henna Shah and I got the chance to speak to Southampton Labour councillor Satvia Kaur and Tanmanjit Singh Desi, Labour MP for Slough. We talked about Sikhs for Labour and diaspora campaigning, the Indian farmer protests, the proud ignorance of this Tory government, and the Sikh tradition of Langar. Thank you to them both for taking the time out to come and speak to us.
Hi everyone, we're joined today on the Progressive Britain podcast by Tan and Satvia. Lovely to have you here. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And it's great to join you, Henna and Satvia.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having us. I'm very excited.
Yeah, thank you both. Just to start off, can you both tell us a bit about yourselves, how you got into politics, and maybe what you see as the role
for Sikhs for Labour in the party?
Well, look, in terms of me getting into politics, it's one of those, I think, where the path has found me rather than me setting out on a particular path. My aim in life wasn't to become an MP or even a councillor, but it just happened gradually. My aim in life was to try to set up my own small family business, just as my parents had done. So I wanted to emulate them, and that's exactly what I did after university. I went off to work in Bonnie, Scotland, in the construction business that I'd become accustomed to, because that's what I'd seen my parents do. So we had a small family business run from our garage. Mum used to be doing all the paperwork, all the bookkeeping and timesheets and everything else. And my dad used to go out and about with a drilling rig, with a van, and especially in and around London for work. So I'd been blooded into the construction business, and that's exactly what I did in wonderful Scotland for 3 years. But I'd been a Labour Party member, it's been donkey's years now, since uni days, I think. But I was just a card-carrying member. I wasn't involved in electoral politics in any way, because I thought that's somebody else's job. That should be like somebody like Satvia on the screen. You know, that's what they do, isn't it? You know, somebody else has got to be doing the councillorship and the MPs and stuff. We just pay our subs because we want to support the Labour movement. We want to support the left. I was approached in 2003 to become a councillor. And at that time, because I was in Scotland, I had to respectfully decline. But then in 2007, when they approached me again, after a lot of consultation with the family, my wife, parents, everybody, and they said, yes, look, you can do your day job, and then in the evenings and on weekends, you can contribute. And it just went from there. The more and more I got involved in council business, in voluntary organisations. So I've served as a trustee of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Support Services, the MenCap Society, school governor at a couple of schools and so on. It just went there. I just got more and more sucked in. And then I went on to become the chair of the CLP. Then that was because somebody who was a lot more experienced than me, she was standing there, and a few of them said, why don't you become the chair? You've done well in the chamber. In the council chamber, it'd be great to have somebody younger, somebody with a turban, heading up the local party. And so I was unanimously elected as the CLP chair. That's what normally happens. I think Samir will tell you is that basically you get arm twisted, and if nobody else is volunteering, then you get put forward. So I loved doing that. So I was chair for about 4 years, became the local mayor. And then lo and behold, in 2017, Theresa May decided that she wanted to have an election because she was 24 odd points ahead. And so I'm eternally grateful to her for having taken that decision. I put in for the vacant seat of Slough. And yeah, from I think about 150 odd, I managed to get the party nomination. And for the last 4 years, I've been serving as the MP of Slough.
What a story. Is that Vic?
So I'm born and bred Southampton, grew up in the inner city on free school meals, come from quite a traditional, I suppose, Punjabi community. My dad was a market trader. If I'm being honest, never in a million years did I ever see myself in politics as a local councillor, representing kind of my community. And it's absolutely incredible. So I got involved with the 2010 general election. I actually bumped into my local MP at the time, John Denham, and it was a real marginal. And I remember saying to him, oh, I don't know, John, I feel really disillusioned. I might vote Lib Dem. And I remember him gasping and saying how much of a two-horse race it is. And I think I said something along the lines of, oh, I'd chop off my right arm to ensure I don't have a Tory as an MP. And he was like, oh, I could really do with people like you on board my campaign. And I remember helping him out. And he won that seat by 192 votes. And everyone in his campaign felt as though they'd personally got him over the line. And I suppose it's the first time that I realised that as individuals, every single conversation you have with someone on the doorstep or kind of phone canvassing and convincing them to vote Labour, that can make the difference between Labour winning and not winning. And I suppose when I got elected, I was asked to stand and I actually ran in an unwinnable seat. It hadn't seen a Labour councillor for over 10 years. And I'm actually on local TV crying. I'm so shocked I won because I wasn't meant to. But it's one of those things that you either really, really love and you found your calling, or because it completely takes over your life, because politics can be a bit all consuming, it's just not. And I suppose, fortunately for me, I feel as though I have found that calling. I really, really love kind of serving my community, listening to local residents, dealing with local issues. I feel as though in local politics, you deal with people's everyday life so much more than national politics. So whether that's, I don't know, helping an elderly person get a dropped curve so she doesn't have to carry heavy shopping down the road, or helping a mum who's having to decide between feeding her son or heating her home with her housing needs, you know that you've made a difference to that person's life. And for me, that's truly special. And I know you, part of your question was around Sikhs in Labour and representation in particular. And I think that having more diverse representation isn't just important because we should reflect the communities we want to serve, but also I've noticed ever since I got elected. So when I got elected, I was one of very few women. I was definitely the youngest by a long shot and the only one of colour. And since then, so I would have been elected for 10 years this coming May. And since then, we've tried really hard to diversify our group. And I have noticed that we do make better, well-rounded decisions as a group because we've got more diverse representation. And that is why it's just so important that we continue.
Really, really powerful. Thank you. Tan, you've been shadow for railways since April last year. I'm wondering what that's like. How's it been? What have the challenges been? What's it been like having that new responsibility?
It's an incredible experience, Joseph. I'll tell you what, is the only problem is I can't choo-choo away on different trains. I can't be standing on platforms. I can't go down to Southampton to catch up with Sata or some of the other people to say, look, you know, this is what we should be doing in terms of rail, learning from them and trying them to formulate and streamline our own rail policies. So that's the one thing that I'm missing. But there's been a lot of zooming about. So I've been catching up with metro mayors up and down the country, with other MPs, with elected officials, with rail groups. And there was a lot of hard work done by my predecessors. So that was Andy McDonald, Rachel Maskell, and I got a good handover from them. They've moved on to other roles within the shadow cabinet, in terms of the shadow ministerial team. And it's been an absolutely wonderful experience. We formulated some policies, certain things that we've carried on. And so we have put out the policy platform that look, we want to take rail back into public ownership. That would be the best way to ensure that we put people before profit. And also in terms of decarbonizing our economy, tackling the climate crisis, the best way to do that is to make sure that we have a solid focus on transport, and in particular, public transport, but in particular, rail. Because rail is one of those sectors which is a very, very low contributor to our carbon emissions. And if we are to make sure that we green our economy, that we take our country forward into the 21st century, then we need to have a mass transit rail system which is sustainable and which is affordable.
Great, thanks, Dan. Yeah, and I think it's a quick reflection before we move on to Satviz. It's really interesting hearing your stories, and thank you for sharing them, in that what that shift is from being a card-carrying member to being someone who's sucked in. And I don't know, I think that's an experience that's common to all Labour members, but I remember that I was a card-carrying member, and I'm from Hounslow, and Brentford and Isleworth was marginal in 2017. And turning up every day to campaign because it was a real marginal, and then meeting some people and then slowly sucking me in and inviting me to various things. And before you know it, you're working in politics and bringing people up, and people are standing you for things. And it is a great thing to see. And I think it's a great thing to see people who look like you and who understand you also try and bring you in, because I've definitely felt that it wasn't for me necessarily either. Satvi, it'd be great to hear from you what it's like to be a councillor and sort of what your role is and a little bit more in Southampton, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course. So I represent Shirley Ward in Southampton, the best ward in the country, I would argue. But I'm also cabinet member currently for Homes and Culture. So that's everything housing related and culture related, which is quite broad. At the moment, I suppose my main housing task is as part of our COVID recovery as a council. So we're a Labour authority. We've pledged to build 1,000 council homes by 2025. But we're really keen that that addresses local housing needs. So they'll be 100% affordable, energy efficient and of quality. I think that what the pandemic has really shown, and especially lockdown, is just how important our home is. It's suddenly turned into a place of work, transformed into a classroom where most of our leisure activity is done. And I think that people that live in shoe cupboards, essentially, or kind of converted office accommodation or high rise blocks have really suffered as a consequence. So we really want to build kind of the next generation of council housing. But so investing to kind of build our way out of the current recession we're heading in. And I, with a housing hat on, Southampton's actually bidding for UK City of Culture, which is very exciting. So as part of our bid, I suppose we're trying to put Southampton on the map, get external investment in, showcase everything great that Southampton has to offer, which is kind of a really exciting time to be in Southampton and be involved in politics. And I suppose for me, all of us joined the Labour Party because we intrinsically believe in Labour values, and I feel so privileged that I'm in a position where I can help deliver those Labour values and make them a reality for local communities. As we're talking about representation, I would say that sometimes it is harder when you're someone of colour, when there aren't people around you. I know you mentioned around seeing people like you, and I think we underestimate the power of role models or seeing people in positions of leadership and authority. I remember when Tan first stood up in the House of Commons, my dad actually had tears in his eyes. It just, seeing someone with a turban on just meant so much for him. And I come from such a traditional family where the role of a woman is so different to a man. But seeing someone like Tan and seeing someone like Preet Gill and other Sikhs doing what they do best in politics has really given confidence to my family to help me achieve what I want to do in politics too.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. I guess I'd like to sort of explore that a little bit more. And I think a thing that I've certainly heard that people experience from lots of communities as women is a sort of reluctance to platform women or put women forward. I don't know, I know it's a little bit of a sensitive subject, but it'd be interesting to know whether you've encountered any of that or whether you, how you think we should tackle that within the community more broadly.
So I suppose for me, I feel like I take so many kind of underrepresented groups. So I come from a working class background. I'm a woman. I'm an ethnic minority. I suppose the combination possibly hasn't helped at times. So my traditional background means that all my family or my siblings and my cousins had arranged marriages, for example. Me and my sisters were the first girls to be allowed in my community to go to university, which was a really big thing. So the plan was, as soon as I got graduated, I was meant to marry someone I hadn't met. And my sisters dutifully did that, but I was a bit of a black sheep in the family. And I couldn't blame my parents, because I think in our community, you associate happiness with marriage. So they just really couldn't understand why I wanted to pursue more politics or have more of an independent life than not get married and have a husband. And I think my dad eventually used to say to people that always used to ask him, no, she is married. She's just married to politics. And I remember my mom constantly worrying, she still does, and says stuff like, you do realise stuff like this just doesn't happen to people like us, as though I'm living some kind of fantasy dream and that one day I'm going to wake up. And I must admit, it does come with its challenges. I've been questioned about why someone like me represents Shirley, which is a predominantly white area. I remember once going for selections and someone quite high up in the party saying, you can't stand because people won't be able to pronounce your name. I still get people say people like you. And it's all this kind of subconscious biased or kind of casual racism that I think that we really need to draw attention to and draw out of the party at the moment. That's not saying that I feel as though I've kind of progressed despite all of that, rather than because of it. But we do have great people within the party, and women in particular in the party have been extremely supportive to me, as have Sikhs for Labour as well.
It's thank you. It's so important to hear those truths, those realities coming from you. People really need to hear that and understand that. Can we turn to the farmers' protest in India? We've all seen on the news recently. It's been everywhere, and perhaps even more important than the economic rationale behind the protests. In recent days, we've seen the Indian government is cracking down on some of those leading the protests. I want to ask how the British Sikh community has reacted to the protests and to the Indian government's response, and what we in the labour movement can do to support the farmers' voices being heard. So maybe, Tan, if we could start with you on that.
Yeah, thank you. Joseph, look, in terms of the farmers' protests within India, those are currently the largest protest on the planet. At any given point in time, there are hundreds of thousands of individuals camped in and around Delhi, but also protesting in other parts of India as well. And overall, given that approximately half of the population, it is said, more than half, in fact, are directly or indirectly linked to farming. Agriculture is a massive industry within India. So you can imagine that you have hundreds of millions of people involved within agriculture. The likes of me, our family heritage is from the rural Punjab. So before my parents emigrated to Slough, so my father came there in the late 70s. But before doing that, he and my mum's side of the family, they were farmers. They were out there tilling the land, my grandparents and so on. You know, so there's a strong connection with the land. And that is the same for so many people within the UK. So if we just take the Sikh community, by the way, these protests are not just for Sikhs. They're not, you know, it is a multitude of individuals. You've got Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Sikh farmers, you know, people of all faith and none who are involved in agriculture out there. So please don't be taken in by any of these misinformation edicts that keep coming out from certain sections of the media within India or from certain people in authority that all these farmers are somehow either separatists or terrorists, or this is just a Sikh issue. That's a load of nonsense. In terms of the Sikh community within the UK, which it comprises approximately 1% of the UK population, so there are about 500,000 Sikhs within the UK. Amongst them, more than 100,000 felt strongly enough and were connected up to the internet that they signed an official parliamentary petition on the subject. So I think the last time I'm looking, it was more than 110,000 plus that signed that petition, which means that there will now be a parliamentary debate. But the likes of myself, when I spoke to friends and family out there in India who were involved, either trade union movement, so all of the farming unions have essentially coalesced around this issue as well, because they are fearful of major corporates moving into agriculture, worried about the encroaching privatization of agriculture. So that's what they are basically fighting for their livelihoods. And many of them, over not just the last few years, but for several decades now, they've seen a drop in their incomes. The rate of suicides has increased. The debt-laden situation of many farmers is very, very saddening to see. So I go back quite often to India, and whenever I go back, I always go back to our ancestral farm to catch up with family and friends and just have that connection. And even with my children, so I've got two young children, they would go out there, would get them to bathe in the water in the little pool that there is in the farm, the same pool which takes the water to the various fields. So you cannot imagine that level of connection and how strongly people feel about it. And that is why thousands of individuals in London, in Birmingham, Swansea, and elsewhere, Cardiff, etc., lots of people have been holding mini protests in their little towns, as well as the larger ones in and around London and in parts of Glasgow. But I tell you what, when we had a meeting about this, we had a cross-party meeting, we put out a letter, 36 MPs signed it, it went out to Dominic Raab, and thankfully he raised it with the Indian Foreign Minister. And then I thankfully, finally, I got to ask a question in PMQs. Because one of the most frustrating things is, which I found, that when I served for about a decade as a councillor, I could basically put up my hand almost at will, as long as I got the mayor to look in my direction, I could speak in that debate. But one of the most frustrating things is, for PMQs, for example, you have to put in to speak, and then about 20-odd individuals' names are chosen, and only they can ask the question. So I hadn't been able to ask a question to Boris Johnson in PMQ since September 2019. That's the only one that I managed to ask. But in December of last year, I stood up to ask a question about the farmers' protest. I said, will the Prime Minister convey to the Indian Prime Minister our heartfelt anxieties and those of our constituents? And does the Prime Minister agree that everybody has a fundamental right to engage in peaceful protest? Joseph, my previous PMQ was quite biting. It was about Islamophobia. But this one was very, very, very soft. I thought, I've given him an in. All he's going to say is, of course I agree with the honourable member, and then I can duly sit down. So I've raised the issue. He started talking about Pakistan. I just thought, are you having a laugh? Just how clueless can somebody be when thousands of individuals have been protesting in the UK and you start talking about India, Pakistan? So it was extremely annoying. Therefore, we then wrote, I organised a letter, and more than 100 MPs signed a letter to the Prime Minister. And we're very, very worried, as you rightly said, Joseph, but we've seen the footage of water cannon, tear gas, and brute force being used against farmers on their way to Delhi and thereafter. So the vast bulk of those farmers, they're peacefully protesting. You've got elderly individuals, people who had fought for India, in the army. Their children are currently out there. Some of them have been beaten up in custody. That's what they've alleged. Trade unionists like Nordeep Kaur, journalists, they've been arrested. Nordeep Kaur, it is alleged, has suffered sexual assault and torture while in police custody. So all of those allegations have been coming. And so the likes of us have been saying that, look, there needs to be a debate. And when I asked the Leader of the House earlier this month about it, he turned around and he didn't even answer the question. He started going off on some other tangent, came up with lots of words, but didn't answer the question. But the best way that people can support this movement is what the unions have done. I tell you what, I'm so, so proud of our unions. War on Want organized a letter, which had the support of the Trades Union Congress. It had all the major trade unions, you know, the likes of Unite, Unison, GMB, the rail unions, RMT, ASLEF, TSSA, and others, loads of others signed that letter to show solidarity with the trade unionists out there in India. You know, I know a lot of members are organizing motions within their CLPs. That's a great way. They're organizing motions within their council chambers as well to write to the Prime Minister to say, look, you know, that there needs to be some sort of intervention, and we need to make sure that those peaceful protesters are saved from any excesses of anybody in authority. You know, it's been great to see that solidarity, but I hope that's given some sort of background to the issue. And also, I tell you what, the farmers have been very, very grateful to the influencers out there, celebrities, to climate change activists, to human rights activists. When they have written in and they've tweeted about it, there have been times when the farmers' protest has been the number one trending issue, not just in India, not just in the UK, but across the globe. So it just shows you the power of people from different backgrounds and perspectives coming together to show solidarity when somebody's fighting for justice.
Satvir, do you share that frustration that Tan speaks about, and do you see a manifestation of that growing attention to this issue in Southampton?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's one of those, and Tan's already covered all of it, where there's such a huge diaspora in the UK from the Punjab. So everyone will be somehow linked or related to farmers in the Punjab. So this idea that I think labour values intrinsically are linked to fighting injustice anywhere, wherever it is. But because there's such an emotional, personal connection, it's just really amplified that within within families, within communities, within cities, which is probably why you've seen this reaction. And I think that what tipped it over the edge was the Prime Minister's reaction to Tan's question. I remember watching it in absolute horror, especially because, I mean, Southampton is the most diverse city on the South Coast. And, you know, we pride ourselves on our community cohesion. So there's Muslims with Sikhs and Hindus and Jews, and we all kind of get along really, really well. The last thing we want is a collective farmers protest that is bringing people together in India, only for our Prime Minister to use it as, like, probably naively, as a way of division between local communities. And kind of, it was just that naivety and ignorance. And I just think in his position, he can't really afford to make those mistakes. It's, quite frankly, it's insulting. Like, just don't do it. You can't get away with being stupid as Prime Minister, in my opinion, especially with something so sensitive. So, yes, I do share Tan's frustration, to put it bluntly. But thank you, Tan, for everything you're doing and everyone else with what they're doing to raise awareness on this important issue.
How do you think that exists within the wider question of the challenges related to campaigning as part of a diaspora? What's that like, and is it frustrating at times to see some of the issues that are important not really understood by the British government, for example?
So I have found, like, especially in Southampton, a lot of our kind of diverse communities are also in our most deprived communities. So a lot of the issues they will raise will automatically be linked to kind of issues you'd get from any working class community anyway. I just think that it's exacerbated because of their ethnicity. There are issues sometimes where are predominantly focused with ethnic minorities, where sometimes it can get frustrating that others don't understand. So a personal one that I helped deal with, which was a few years ago, in a local secondary school, two Sikh girls on their first day of school in year seven, so it was their new school as well, were sent home because they were wearing turbans, to which there was absolute uproar within the local community. So they contacted me, even though technically, I mean, it wasn't my patch, it wasn't my area of responsibility, but because I was a Sikh, because they were saying no one else will understand what this means to us. So I actually had to contact the school, and they genuinely didn't know what they'd done wrong. And they were even a religious school. So they were a Roman Catholic school. And they were like, oh, but it's non-school uniform. to which I had to be like, but it's religious. All they had to do was Google whether girls can wear turbans. I mean, it wasn't rocket science. I even had to ask them to show me where in their guidance on uniform, I said, can you turn to the section that covers turbans? And can you say explicitly where it says you can't wear a turban to school? And then all the family got was an apology and they were let back in. But that damage with the Sikh community and with other faiths as well. I mean, it's the same with Muslim girls and hijabs. You know, that damage with that community was already done. And I think that there's absolutely a frustration with this lack of understanding. But whether you understand something or not, I think that it's indicative of all of us and all institutions to be a bit more open-minded.
And Tan, do you agree? And also, is there anything that you feel is rewarding in being a central campaigner for our diaspora?
Yeah, I fully agree with Sathbir. I think the issues are enriched. Our democracy is enriched when we have people from different perspectives with different priorities coming together because the decisions are ultimately more refined. They've taken into cognizance various aspects of our diverse communities. Now, having more women in Parliament, having more women in the council chambers has made sure that we're discussing those issues, that we have individuals who have those issues in their day-to-day lives. Having people from Black, Asian and minority ethnic communities, or people with disabilities, or people from the LGBT plus community, when they're involved, they help to enrich things. You know, we make much better decisions. And look, sometimes look, we'll all make mistakes. There are times when, even being a Sikh, I'm not the font of all knowledge, and me and Sabir can't proclaim to have some sort of monopoly on all of the issues. Other people can be taking up issues. There have been times when that's happened. So way before the likes of myself rocked up in Parliament, you know, there were others who were doing a very, very good job in taking forward issues with regards to the Sikh community or with regards to other diaspora issues. But I'd like to think that, whether it's the likes of myself or Preet, who was elected in 2017 as well, or Nina Gill, who served previously as the only Sikh member of European Parliament, or you've got Dr. Onkar Sahota, who is the only member of the Greater London Assembly, councillors like those individuals, when they're involved, that you'd like to think that they are making positive contributions. But in terms of those diaspora issues, they do need to be discussed. And I'll tell you what, I am so, so proud to be a member of the British Parliament, because we not only discuss about issues to do with our local communities, so whether it's in Slough or whether it's to do with the UK, while the bulk of the time it is about UK-related issues, but we discuss global issues. If we keep hearing this soundbite about global Britain, well, it can't just be a mere soundbite, because we do practice what we preach. You know, we discuss about human rights across the globe. So if, by the way, anybody ever tries to shut up somebody by saying, well, look, this just relates to our particular country, how dare somebody else speak about that? It's like, no, human rights are universal. That's the answer to that little question, because I've often seen, when I've been trolled on social media, and while we've got lots of supporters on social media, especially within the labour movement, you know, people showing solidarity across the globe, but I've got a fair bit of trolls and a lot of people coming up with, poke your nose out, don't get involved in this. Why are you talking about Myanmar? Why are you talking about Hong Kong and the atrocities against the Uyghurs or the Buddhists or the Christian minorities in China? Why are you talking about Palestine? I said, that's our role, mate. We're in Britain and we're proud to be speaking up about those issues. If something is happening, it doesn't matter whether it's happening in India and Pakistan, that's not just your little domain. if there's a crackdown, then we will be speaking up about that. And those issues do need to be discussed. And I think that can be seen just by the level of engagement on social media and discussions, because it's become a platform whereby we can see what is happening within various communities. I do hope that those issues will continue to be discussed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Great. Yeah. And I completely agree about the amount of attention that the farmers' protest has brought. I think I remember seeing, was it Rihanna tweet and say, why aren't we talking about this? Which is incredible, I think, testament to the fact that people really care. And it's an issue that's really brought people together as a global community to say, look at all these people. Why are they protesting? What are they up against? And I think a little bit of what you touched on sort of feeds into what I want to ask about now, which is thinking a little bit about racism within the Labour Party. Obviously, it's been a significant issue at the moment and is something that exactly sort of, as you kind of alluded to, Tan, a thing that people of colour and people from ethnic minorities have been working on a long time. But it'd be great to hear a little bit about perhaps your personal experiences, if you're happy to share them, whether you've encountered it or how it's perhaps affected your journey within the Labour Party.
Yeah, well, look, Labour Party, we know, was founded on the principles of equality, of social justice. One of the reasons why the likes of me are in the Labour Party is because whether it was my grandparents, my parents, my grandfather, who was a teacher and a committed socialist, he was constantly telling me stories about what happened during the 60s. My parents were telling me about what happened in the 70s and 80s and how, when they needed solidarity, it was the Labour Party that was treating them as equal citizens, that was standing up for their rights, while the Tories were too busy engaging in culture wars and trying to talk about some sort of invasion of the rivers of blood, or talking about Nelson Mandela as, you know, they're all terrorists, and some young Tories and others having T-shirts emblazoned with "Let's hang Nelson Mandela," when Labour was the one that was talking about anti-apartheid and courting arrests. Those stories have, you know, had a very, very special place in my heart, and that's why I'm subscribed to those socialist values, those values of solidarity, which is so emblematic of our trade union movement as well. But unfortunately, as with other organisations, because we are, you know, literally it's a subscription where anybody can off the street can go on to join and become a member of the Labour Party. We've got more than 500,000 members. We're the largest political party in Western Europe. So with that level of membership, unfortunately, we may have certain elements within us who are either racist or sexist or homophobic. There is no place for those people. So we need to weed out those individuals, people who are not aligned to our values, So we have to face up to those demons. And when, I know that when we had issues with regards to anti-Semitism, we've got other issues, whether it's with regards to Islamophobic comments or anti-Sikh comments. Those individuals, they need to be dealt with. And so I'm proud that we took that bull by the horns, that we had the independent inquiry into anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. And a lot of work is being done by the Labour Party nationally, as well as locally, to hold those people to account and have those investigations. But we need to be progressing faster, because especially if anybody is an elected representative, a councillor or an MP or a member of one of the devolved authorities, the parliaments, if any of them are displaying any such features, then they should have no place within our party. So that's what we need to, we know what we need to deal with. By the way, that doesn't stop us from holding other political parties to account. So in particular, the Conservative Party, you know, just because we've got certain unscrupulous elements that we're dealing with, at the same time, we need to call out others. And whether that includes Boris Johnson with his litany of sexist and racist remarks, he needs to be held to account, because just as you know, the likes of myself have pointed out in the chamber, they, within the Conservative Party, promised that there would be an independent inquiry into Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. And there have been so many instances of such the things occurring. And yet to this day, they have not ordered an independent inquiry into Islamophobia. But while we're doing that, let's sort our own house out as well. And I think we are well on the way to dealing with those issues.
Great. Satvia, do you have any reflections on that? Is there anything from your experience you'd like to share?
So, I mean, Tan's absolutely right in reflecting kind of the history of the Labour Party, our values intrinsically linked to being anti-racist. I'm really proud and happy that we're getting so strong on this and trying to fight it out of our party. I think it was Keir that said, one racist is too many in the party, and kind of just really rooting out that casual racism as well, because I think that once you allow people to get away with that, it can escalate. So I'm really happy that, I mean, I know some will argue that we're coming down too hard, but I'm quite happy that we are trying to make a marker to show people that we're taking this seriously. I do also agree, and Tan's kind of a great representation of this, that we all have a collective fight here. This isn't about Sikhs versus Muslims versus kind of the LGBTQ plus community. You know, all of the kind of prejudices and discrimination that each of us feel should be fought and championed by all of us. You know, we've all got a role to play to support each other. And I think that, you know, Tan, you've mentioned, I think your first question was around women with hijabs and letterboxes. And to this day, our Prime Minister still hasn't apologised for that comment. And I feel as though people in positions of responsibility do have a responsibility to watch what they say and how they say stuff. I don't think they've got the privilege to get away with it. You know, they've put themselves in that position for a reason. And so, you know, we are in a collective fight. The only other thing I wanted to mention was this whole tokenism versus representation. You know, a lot of people that are of colour or all from underrepresented groups often get attacked. I know I do, Tan, I'm sure you do, with this idea that you're only there because you have a different colour skin, or you're only there because you're gay, or you're a lesbian, or you're disabled. And actually, you can be there because you're just bloody good at what you do. And I think we just need to get over this. And I don't think it's just a Labour Party problem. I do think it's a societal problem. I still will walk into the cabinet room after having done, I don't know, politics south, or, you know, an interview on the TV, and my colleagues will turn around and say, oh, did they need another brown person on the TV? Is that why you were chosen? And while they kind of a jokey, jesty way, you know, it's stopped becoming funny. And I just think we need to, especially within the Labour Party, just deal with stuff like that head on, that, you know, true representation isn't tokenism. And the more we can get people from different backgrounds in positions of responsibility, I think that that will become less.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting reflection. And just to explore that a little bit more, I think we've seen, I mean, over the past however many years, sort of inquiry after inquiry, and thinking of McPherson and others into the nature of racism within the UK. And obviously around COVID, we've seen the disproportionate impact on both COVID as an illness, but also on the sort of social aspects of it, whether it's around the economy or housing or other things like that, and how it has impacted marginalized groups more than others. Wonder if you have any reflections on what that's meant for the people you serve and how they've got through the present time. Maybe Tan, do you want to go first?
Yeah, Hannah, in terms of people within South, particularly hard hit as a community, if we talk about Black, Asian, minority ethnic communities, disproportionately impacted by coronavirus in terms of the number of deaths, the number of cases, I think that's also got to do with a whole plethora of issues with regards to socioeconomic factors, where those communities are living, often in urban areas where it's there's a lack of space. They are living in either congested or unsuitable housing, as is the case in many cities. So where the transmission of the virus is a lot more rampant. There are also issues with regards to the communities where they are used to living in extended families. So that has also had an impact whereby even if somebody of a working age is going out to work, they are coming back. And so often they're not just living with their children, but also their parents and sometimes grandparents. So there's three or four generations within one household. So that's had an impact. And also people from the Black, Asian, minority ethnic communities, they're often in jobs as key workers. So front-facing roles, so whether it's in terms of bus drivers, taxi drivers, doctors, nurses, those sort of professions have meant that we have been disproportionately impacted. There's no two ways about that. And I think the statistics bear that out as well. I personally, I've been severely impacted in the sense that we've lost close family members. So my grandmother contracted COVID and sadly passed away. My uncle, who was a taxi driver in Slough, he was 60 odd, and the next minute we knew he was on a ventilator and gasping for his final breath, and he passed away. My brother-in-law's father, who had somehow contracted COVID in a Slough care home, that there are so many stories in households across the country, especially within BAME communities, and I think that is very, very saddening. We just need to make sure that government and people in local authorities as well, that they're aware of these issues, so that we help those communities to come out of this pandemic, because many of them will also have lost their jobs because it's an economic impact as well. So, for example, in Slough, it's a very diverse community. It's literally the world in microcosm, where we've got large populations of Scottish, Irish, Welsh, Polish, Indian, Pakistani, Afro-Caribbean communities all milling around. But many of them are actually working in and around Heathrow, for example. The aviation sector, because it's had such a devastating impact this pandemic has had on that particular sector, that means that many of those people who had that dignity of going and working hard for their living, they no longer have a job. And they are scratching around thinking, what's going on? And now they have to rely on the welfare state. And that's another one of the reasons why, I'm proud that Labour, we constantly stand to make sure that we strengthen our welfare state, because you never know when you might need that welfare state. The journey from it's written within the sacred Sikh scriptures, the Guru Granth Sahib, the journey from a king to a pauper is what you might seem to believe. So that it's those reasons that I think going forward as well, that we now need to look at the mental health impact on those that have lost their jobs, those that aren't able to provide for their families, and the mental health impact on young people as well, because the closure of schools and the inability of people to go and get an education, unfortunately, there's been a disproportionate negative impact on the more disadvantaged sections of our community, and that those inevitably, unfortunately, end up being communities that we represent as Labour MPs, as Labour councillors. So there's a great deal of work to be done going forward, but I think working together, hopefully, with wonderful people in the voluntary sector as well, who have been doing an amazing job, and people in faith groups, that we can overcome this adversity.
Great, thanks, Tan. Satvia, do you have anything to add on that?
I think Tan covered it really well. The only, I'm really pleased he mentioned mental health, only because fortunately I haven't lost anyone to COVID, but unfortunately I recently lost a friend to mental health. You know, he sadly took his own life. And so I do think mental health among young people is kind of is really serious at the moment, and as a country and locally we need to do more on that. Also, I think the coronavirus has impacted women so much more than men. You know, all the statistics show at the moment how they have been disproportionately affected, and actually coming out will be socially and economically far worse off. So what can we put in place now to try and mitigate that? As a local authority, we desperately really struggle. So our pressure in the air is in excess of 20 million, which we've had to find. At the beginning, we were told, do whatever it takes, we'll be there for you. And we did whatever it took, and the government aren't there for us. So that's having a huge impact on our budget. So we've got a budget meeting coming up next week. And you just, at moments like this, you feel as though you didn't join politics to make these kind of decisions, but you feel forced to, because we've got a Tory government that, quite frankly, doesn't care about local communities, which is really tough. What I do think, and I suppose in a positive way, I'm really pleased that Keir mentioned this whole 1945 moment, and how, as a country, this is our opportunity to stop and restart. And this is about, I mean, in post-war, it was a Labour Party that created and built the NHS, started a huge council home building programme. You know, they reinvented the UK and our country as it is today. And it's our opportunity to try and do that again, so we can stop and restart and actually say goodbye to austerity. Because the reason why this country in particular has had it so badly is because it came after a decade worth of austerity measures. And that's why I think it just uncovered all the inequality that was already there within our communities.
Yeah, that is such a crucial point to almost end on. We're really grateful for both of you for coming on and providing your insight. But I want to ask maybe a bit of a lighter question to finish. If you could both tell us one thing that people like Kenna and I in the Labour Party, non-Sikhs in the Labour Party, should know about Sikhs for Labour, one thing you want the party in general to know about Sikhs for Labour, what you're doing, what you stand for. Either of you can go first.
Oh, sorry, Tan, I was going to let you go first.
Yeah, brilliant. I was just about to say ladies first, but look, I'm always happy. Look, Sikhs for Labour, one of the best things about the Sikh community that everybody should be aware of is this institution called Langar, which is free food, free community kitchen food that has been in existence for centuries. Indeed, it was such a preeminent feature of the Sikh faith that the Sikh guru said that anybody who's coming to meet me, if they do not eat in the community kitchen, if they do not eat in the Langar, then they don't need to come and see me. That's how much of an institution. And the reason for it, by the way, is not about food. If somebody thinks, whenever you see a Labour Party conference, you'll see a whole bunch of Sikhs like Satvia and me standing around, and you know, we're handing out apples or other fruit because, unfortunately, you know, we can't have the curry and the rice and the chapatis and whatever. So it's your five a day, Joseph. Yeah, and just make sure. Seriously, in terms of why we would all be doing that at virtually every single Labour Party conference, is that we align our Sikh values with our socialist values. It's about sharing with others, and it's about that institution of Langar. But the reason why we have that institution is centuries ago, so 500 odd years ago, there in certain parts of the Indian subcontinent where people wouldn't even sit down with each other, they wouldn't prepare food together. There was a thing called the caste system, so certain people wouldn't interact. They felt that certain people were inferior to them and so on. And so what the guru said is that, look, everybody's equal, whether it's male, female, whether it's people with black, white, brown, whatever it is, people will prepare this food together. The food will be through donations from Sikhs, from the community. Having prepared the food, we will then together serve it and eat it. So it was a leveler, and everybody had to sit on one level as well, because before certain people would be sitting higher, others lower, and so on. So it was the leveling up aspect. Oh my God, we're getting into like a Tory territory of leveling up agenda. No, it's about leveling everybody up or leveling everybody down, you know, just to make sure that everybody keeps their feet on the ground and that we practice what we preach, so we have that equality. So that's the one thing that I would say in terms of Sikh. You'll see wherever the Sikhs, they will be making sure that they feed everybody. And by the way, that langar is not just for the Sikh community. It is for everybody. And it's always like vegetarian food. Because it's a large proportion of the Sikhs, by the way, who are vegetarian, the likes of myself. I think food is one of those beautiful things which bring people together. So watch out for that.
Beautiful story. As a vegan, I fully
connect. All right, good.
Yes, langar, one of my favourite things. I do really miss langar at the moment. It's heartbreaking not being able to come with everybody and eat it. One thing that people should know about the Sikh community, this is really basic, and hopefully most people know, but every Sikh female will have the middle name Kaur, and every Sikh male will have the middle name Singh, and it's to draw on that that symbolism Sikhs have around equality. So the idea was, because we originated from Hindus and Muslims, and Hindus in particular had this huge caste system, to get rid of that caste system, everyone's surname was taken away and they all had the same name. So while technically I do have a surname, I never use it. I always use my middle name, Kaur, because I think it's just so special and powerful that my name kind of literally represents equality, which is really special for me. And I just want other Sikhs to be able to relate to it. So I'm a very proud Kaur, as I'm sure Tan is a very proud Singh.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you both.
Great.
For those answers, thank you for coming on. It's been really, really interesting, and I'm sure our listeners are going to really enjoy this episode.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this, by the way. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.